Welcome back to the Great Dive Podcast, everybody. You're here with the Bicker Brothers, Jamesy and Brando, bickering about scuba podcasting.
You couldn't podcast your way out of a paper bag.
That's because you're a loser. I'm carrying you on every podcast. If I didn't podcast so slowly, you'd never be able to keep up.
You podcast so slowly because you're older than you look, slow-ass podcaster.
I don't know how you can... I had a little brother. You were a little brother. I had
no,
a little
no,
brother.
No, I have a little brother.
I'm sorry. You have a little brother, but you were a middle child, though, weren't you?
No, I was the oldest.
Were you the oldest? I never thought you were the oldest. Right. I always look at you like you were a little brother.
Look how mature I am.
I never looked at you as an older brother, because I'm older, but... There you go. Maybe your little brother looks at you like you're an older brother. Of course he does. I've seen him look at you like that. Because he looks down on you.
Brando, you know what's coming up this weekend is St. Patrick's Day.
A wee diddly diddly, the old St. Patty's.
A wee diddle diddle, mate.
The Erringo bro.
Top of the morning to you. Everybody, this episode of the Great Dive Podcast is brought to you by the St. Patrick's Day Shamrock Shavers. You know them. Manscaped.
Shamrock Shavers. Whoa.
That's right, Brando. This year, don't just go chasing rainbows. Make your own pot of gold and groom your little leprechaun with the leaders in below-the-kilt care.
Take care of those lucky charms.
That's right.
They say are goodbye. Magically delicious.
Say goodbye to your clover forest with Manscaped's Lawnmower 5.0. Let your confidence shine bright. It's time for you, Brando, to embrace the luck of the Irish. And join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. Head over to manscaped.com and use our code TGDP for 20% off and free shipping. Brando, you know, ever since I started using Manscaped, you know, a couple years ago now, since they've been supporters of the show.
Yeah.
I can proudly say that I definitely found my pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
I bet you did.
You know, when you're trimming your hedges in your Irish garden, it's not just for below the belt. Now, look at Brando. He's got his Beard Hedger Pro kit, giving him that genuinely handsome Manscaped look. Top and bottom. There you go, everybody. Whether you're sculpting your beard or cleaning up your balls.
Or you could do your whole goddamn body, couldn't you?
You can do your whole body nowadays, exactly. Clean up your neckline. These are always the right tools for the job in your little Manscaped Shed 2.0 toiletry bag. So get over there, people. Get 20% off free shipping with the code TGDP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping. With the code TGDP at manscaped.com. This St. Patrick's Day, make sure your little hairy leprechaun is luckier than ever with Manscaped. Brando, where we last left the people.
Does Manscaped have a little jingle or anything like that? I'm sorry, but we'll get back to this. But, like, Manscaped.
Manscaped. Da, da, da. Da, da, da.
Yeah, you know, because those things used to just hook people in. By Menon. You remember By Menon, don't you?
Oh,
how could you forget it?
By Menon.
Maybe we could start something for Manscaped.
I just did. Manscaped. Da, da, da. Brando, where we last left the people, we were watching Chris and Chrissy Rouse motherfuck each other as they got into the water.
Yeah, yeah.
At each other's throats like they did on virtually every dive boat that they... We're passengers aboard.
Right.
Up until that wonderful moment for everybody else on the boat when they finally submerged below the surface and their voices could no longer be heard.
I do have to say, like, throughout the book, Bernie mentions how entertaining everyone thought the Bicker Brothers were in many respects.
Yeah, you know, I guess
I never got that idea that... I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jamesy. I never got that idea that... Like they were despised or hated for their bickering. Although when I'm reading the book, not that I hate them, but I just go, guys, just get in your corners and shut up.
Right. Well, I don't think they would continue to get invites.
Right.
If they genuinely didn't entertain people for part of the trip as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I get you. Although I don't think we're going to talk about it, but like even their initial open water course, that when they were doing open water dives, that they got in so much bickering, if you will, that they had to be separated.
Oh, I think this was in every aspect of yeah. their life.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, from the time they got up together in the morning, you know, it was constant, you know, bickering about how you're eating your Lucky Charm cereal.
Yeah, I hear we diddly diddly.
Bickering about how unmanscaped you were back in the 90s, you know, making fun of Chrissy's hair and
yeah.
unshavenness, but it's okay for Dad to be unshaved, you know. It's well, you
do,
know, I think they
bickered
about everything.
Yeah, I'm only trying to clarify it because it can come across in the podcast as if we're saying they hated each other or they disliked each other, while clearly in the beginning of the book when Bernie is describing Sue and Chris's relationship and when they had their baby in their young days, you know, he really loved his kid. So,
oh, I think he truly loved his kid, but I think they just have those personalities that the way you express your love and admiration for somebody is by criticizing them.
Is that how you express your love for me?
That's not how you put your gear together.
What are you doing?
What
hey,
are you
hey,
doing?
You schmuck.
You're a loser.
Yeah, that was a big term back then, too, because I know it can come across right now, like, holy, that's a pretty harsh criticism right there, or a pretty harsh brand.
Yeah, but back in the 90s,
yeah, everyone
it's how you told your kid you loved him.
Yes, you loser.
It's how you told your dad he was the greatest.
Do you want to grow up to be a loser like so-and-so, and that's like your best buddy. You're going, hey, right. Hey, what the fuck, Dad? What?
Well, Brando, you are correct in what you said. You know, we might have sounded a little too harsh about them last week.
Yeah.
Because it isn't the whole book is just them bickering. It's thrown in all along the way to kind of bring up the point
dynamic
of their dynamic and illustrate what the Bicker Brothers really means. But a whole nother third of the book really is about Bernie himself.
Old Bernie.
In many ways, it's a little bit of an autobiography of him
yeah.
as well. And then there's also another third of the book is just like the history of scuba kind of thrown in along the way too.
How many thirds do we have here?
And there's another third that's just about the last dive.
And the last four thirds
are... And there's another third that's the whole introduction.
Exactly. No, you're right. This does have a great chapter on Bernie's own struggle with decompression sickness on what he would probably have described as not a mundane dive, but a fairly novice technical dive that he, you know, could probably do in his sleep.
And that's exactly what ended up happening is he took the dive for granted. You know, getting out, doing a lot of these dives in the 250-foot range, 200-plus foot range on the regular, to go do a dive to 150 is like, pah!
It's 150.
What is this? The swimming pool?
Yeah. A buck fifty.
But like we said last week, Bernie got certified in the mid-80s. And by 88, he himself wasn't an instructor. And he got into doing some active northeast shipwrecks, yeah. Wreck diving. He was another one that, you know, was a cave diver, went down and took his cave diving training and tried to bring a lot of that back to the Northeast Wreckers.
Yeah.
With many, many times, you know, at odds with the community there.
Well, I mean, the Northeast Shipwreck Crew, I can remember the fighting still going on in the early 2000s online, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s. And I personally was part of going to the Northeast and meeting some of these wreck divers and helping teach them the fundamentals, the cave diving techniques, if you will. I can remember the silly ass bickering right there, and the name calling, and the sometimes wanting to go, you know, fisticuffs, if you will.
And in this time of the late 80s, early 90s, the Northeast wreck diving community, much like the Great Lakes wrecking community, was, you're going deep, so you'll need more air. Just keep strapping on additional single tanks to your gear.
Yeah. And as we learned, you know, from last week, there was a kind of a general thought in the shipwreck diving community that helium was bad. It was the voodoo gas and was to be avoided. And there was oxygen being used, but I think it was probably along the same lines as helium. It was just rare. It was mostly everybody did the dives on air and decode on air. And that's why you've got decos going into the two-hour range in open ocean, which is questionable. That's a questionable plan, you know, to actually plan to do a dive and then let's do two-plus hours of deco.
Because that's a completely different ballgame than trying to pull off two-plus hours of deco in an environment like a cave.
Very
controlled. Where the weather change isn't going to have an effect. But when you're out in open ocean,
yeah,
like what we're going to see happen with the Chris and Chrissy last dive, that was something that happened is the weather kicked up.
Which they knew, though. They knew going into it that the shit was coming.
And it didn't make things easier.
No, but they still made that decision. Of course, his dad, you know, Chrissy's dad calling him a pussy. And then he goes, okay, we'll do it. And then Chris tries to...
I was just kidding.
Yeah.
Right, right. So, like we said last week, you know, that whole first chapter really, really describes the getting ready to get into the water on that dive.
Yeah.
And then on chapter two... Bernie kind of takes us back in time to when Chris and Chrissy were non-divers back in the late 80s and just kind of getting introduced by their friends, their pilot friends, about scuba diving. And at first, you know, Chris is like, nah, not for me.
Yeah, he thought it was nuts.
But then he kind of gets him and Chrissy to a class and they immediately fall in love with it.
Of course you do.
Talk mom into getting certified.
The sea is a beautiful temptress.
He, you know, within a year, they get down to Florida and they're in an intro to cave class.
Yeah.
Falling in love with that.
Right.
Bernie does a great job about, you know, describing how they walk into the dive shop at Ginny and it's like nothing they've ever seen at any dive shop anywhere. Yeah. I mean, there's no neon green fluffy BCDs. There's no neon pink fins.
This is business.
It's
yeah,
webbing and steel
hardcore
and clips and D-rings. And they're just like, oh, man, this is like some manly, tough-looking. What is this? Is this scuba diving still? And they were into it. Like, this is... This they were going to identify. This is the kind of diver I want to look like.
I don't know. You described it more like a BDSM shop there, James. What are these guys into? What's going on here?
Pass me the redundant cat of nine tails.
Here, I've got to carry a spare ball gag in my pocket. It's my left pocket today.
Clip it off.
Clip it off.
Make sure you clip that off. You don't want that thing just coming out all willy-nilly.
Oh, boy.
Brando, in chapter three, there's a chapter called Pretzel Logic, where, as Bernie's describing to us, the early 1990s and the Rouses diving Ginny Springs and taking their mixed gas class from Sheck Exley and stories along the way. He goes on really long about decompression in general. Gives a real thorough description of everything that's happening with DCS. Really setting the stage for things that are about to happen throughout the book. And then, you know, very well crafted, you know, he kind of brushes that in and then moves on and away from it. And in many ways, you know, the reader kind of forgets about the DCS because he moves into talking about something way more exciting, like artifacts and artifact fever and the draw to dive in these Northeast shipwrecks and being able to not just swim around a shipwreck, not be able to just swim around in a cave and looking at rocks, but the ability to come back with booty.
And some things never change.
That's right.
In that chapter, Pretzel Logic, Bernie says himself, he says, in 1990, the use of anything other than air for sport dives was considered radical and dangerous. There were no official classes offered for the sport diver interested in using helium breathing mixtures. The public thinks of diving into caves and shipwrecks as dangerous for a good reason. Only recently, since the 1950s, has diving even become a sport. I mean, there's a little kind of painting of the picture of how we were looking at technical diving in those 90s, especially with mixed gases. They didn't use them. It was the voodoo gas, just like Richie Kohler said last week.
Right. It's a lot of just because when you look at this in the 1980s, right? I mean, scuba is really a relatively young man at
it's
the time.
It's a teenager. I think it's a teenager. Yeah.
You know, it's still new. The only thing that humans have really ever breathed was air. So, of course, you're going to put air in the bottle to go to depth, and you're just going to deal with the ramifications as you go deeper and deeper and deeper. The science wasn't really coming along. But as he moves out of Chapter 3 into Chapter 4, he starts introducing Captain Billy Deans down in Key West, who was doing these dives in the 250 range, and Michael Menduno and Aquacore magazine coming out looking at a different view than what these guys were doing of like, hey, if we start applying some science into this, we're realizing that there's smarter ways to dive than deep air.
Right, exactly.
And we get introduced to Bill Hamilton and the dive tables that Dr. Bill Hamilton used to make up for these guys. And then Bernie decides he's going to do something unheard of, which is we're going to do a Doria trip. And we're going to basically do the first ever cave-style dives on the Doria. Because up to this point, I mean, a lot of the diving in the Northeast wrecks was still wetsuits, single tanks,
yeah,
air,
as it was here in the Great Lakes.
Progressive penetration, which basically meant you peeked your head in until you could kind of remember what it looked like. And then on the next dive, you put your whole body in until you remember.
In your narcosed state of, buzz.
Right, right.
Yeah, your buzzed state of narcosis, I should say.
And there's still that argument today in a lot of places.
Oh, yeah. It hasn't gone away completely. It's still alive in some of the old-timers who cling to that. Probably even some young-timers. But how many dives do you think it would require on a wreck like the Doria on a good size wreck to gain enough confidence in your memory to actively go into the shipwreck to get your quote unquote booty and come on out and have the confidence like, yeah, I'll make it back home. I've got it memorized.
Oh yeah. No kidding. I think the in a way there's a little bit of merit to that as well. I mean, there should be a little bit of a blending of the two. In my idea, like just tying up a line and just wing zipping that, you know, spool, you know, as far as you can go isn't necessarily the safest thing either. As we're going to see what happens with Chris and Chrissy later, right? Just having the reel is no guarantee that you're coming home. There's a lot that goes into it besides just having that line home.
I would say so. And if you've had a decent cave diving instructor to initiate you into the cave diving world, they would really put an emphasis on that. There's a constant snapshot taking, if you will, of where am I? What does this look like? Stop and turn around and look. So when you enter the cave, the going in does not look the same as the coming out. So you have to stop, turn around, take a little snapshot, a mental snapshot. Okay, this is what this looks like here. Know where your tie-offs are. Pay attention. Have your brain clicked on. That's the kind of thing you really are relying on when you go cave diving. The line, to a certain degree, is your backup of getting home.
Yeah, there's a blend of the both.
Yeah.
Right, you have to have, and I can understand like these guys early on, like arguing, and maybe that was the case of where they got to where they were is, you know how many goddamn dives it took me, you know, in order to be able to get far enough in that I could get some artifacts.
Right, and then these guys
are just going to come in with your silly ass cave line and go cruising back to the third quarters.
I get it, I get that too. Yeah, but the cave divers, their whole mission was to push farther in, versus the mission of the wreckers really was to get an artifact or two, or you know, find some interesting piece of the wreck to identify it or get its history. Where the cavers, distance, how much can I see, how far can I get?
Right, and I think for the wreckers, the diving was about balls and how tough and badass of a son of a bitch you were, versus the cavers at the time had to have a cleanliness and a finesse to their diving in order to be able to get through the flow and get the distance that they wanted. Where the wreckers, especially these guys out of the Northeast, they were going to pillage. So they were just crashing into the bottom. They were digging through the silt. They weren't trying to have the finesse of technique that that the cave guys were, which is where Bernie and the Rouses were like, hey, we can blend these two together.
Well, like, you know, cave divers are like James Bond, you know, suave, sophisticated, mental. And the wreckers are more like, just like you say, balls. If they had their Manscaped, you know, who would be using more Manscaped? Probably both of them. We can get both of this demographic.
Back then, they both needed it. I mean, exactly. You ever look at pictures of either of those guys? They're all bearded and hairy.
But yeah, one was very, very much about finesse and technique and a whole lot of brains as far as paying attention and awareness. The wreckers were a lot more, like you say, it was all bravado and brawn and balls, if you will. So,
and that's what you had to have, you know, male or female, because there was a lot of, you know, female divers that we get introduced, you know, throughout this book, like Sally Warman and
Barb Lander.
I mean, the ladies are in there, but they're doing the same thing. It's I'm kind of crawling my way in.
Yeah.
As if, you know, this boat were on land and I'm just going to blindly dig and see if I can find some artifacts to shove in this goodie bag. Which is where we get to chapter 6. He really describes the Doria as the steel cave, because in 1991, you know, the Rouses and he on this Doria trip, Doria 91 trip, really tried to introduce some of these cave diving techniques into this community.
I guess my thing would always have been, how could it hurt to have better technique? And how could it hurt if you have line discipline? If you don't have line discipline and you're running a line, if you're unaware of how to use that line, it's a death trap.
And I think that is why a lot of the community back then was so against it, because there was nobody really teaching the finesse and the technique of a line. I mean, even, you know, Chris and Chrissy, when you look at how they were running, it's not how we run a line today.
No.
You know, it was with just a big, you know, clip on the end of it and just snap it on something and one person goes in and one person hangs back. It's different, but it was the growth of it back then. I mean, this is how we, I think in many ways, you know, what that community was looking at is the line was a clusterfuck. Wait, you're going to run that line in there? It's already hard to move around, and now you're going to add line in? That's why a lot of the guys were pissed off at the idea of them trying to bring these techniques into their community where it doesn't belong. You get your goddamn line back down in North Florida, you keep it there.
Well, it's understandable. They've got a great point because in their mind, you're just running a line through the middle of a passageway versus how, again, like you said, we do it today where the line is very selectively placed to stay out of the main swimming area. And the idea is I need this line on the way home in a no-viz situation, so I have to place it not only in a good location, but in a way that I can still follow it blind by feel.
Now, at this time, Brando, they successfully complete the Doria trip. A couple months later, Bernie's going back to the Doria. At the same time, the market's kind of collapsing. The economy's taking a dump, and the Rouse's excavating business is not doing well at all. So Bernie invites him out again, but they were broke. He invites him to do this dive on the Northern Pacific, and Chris has to, you know, regretfully say no to because they don't have the money for it right now. In the meantime, Chris and Chrissy have got the cave diving bug, and they're, you know, this is where they're like, you know, it'd be great if we could find a cave here, you know, right in home.
Pennsylvania. You know? Yeah.
And they did end up finding one that they kind of talk about for a bit. They start exploring and looking for something awesome to really put their name on a map of cave diving here in Pennsylvania in the east of the Midwest, East Coast kind of Appalachia area of America. But it turns out to be a little bit of a dud for them. It doesn't go that far. It's not that elaborate. And they end up getting kicked out because they stir up all this water, which supplied a little bit of a mountain resort with water. And all the customers started getting muddy showers and muddy water coming out of the sinks. And so that got squashed. Now, Bernie did a couple of solo dives on his second Doria trip. And then, you know, he goes in, you know, in great detail about the whole discussion between, you know, and about solo diving versus buddy diving and buddies versus solo.
Solos versus buddies.
You know, he describes, you know, his return trip back to the Doria a few weeks later, diving with John Griffith and, you know, once again, you know, running the dives on deep air, trying to get into a closet and look for some cool artifacts. And on his, you know, last dive on that trip, Griffith doesn't want to go as deep and as far in as Bernie. So Bernie does a solo dive there. Again, and this is a time of air and 240 feet of water, diving independent doubles, just grabbing for plates. And he describes his solo dive as kind of being like, it's, you know, kind of nice that there's no one there to bother me, no one there to judge me. There's nobody that I've got to look after. There's kind of like a cowboy, you know, freedom to it, especially after knowing that he did a dive, you know, the 3.5 hour dive, and it was successful for him.
Yeah. It's a long time in the water and the
in 40 degree Fahrenheit water. That's a long dive, man.
Exactly. That's my whole point. And this was before, you know, electric heat and all the good stuff and all the super high tech undergarments we have now.
Now, about halfway through chapter 7, Bernie's going to do his trip to the Northern Pacific. Chris ended up having to sell his plane. Sold off his life insurance policy. Business is not good. They bail out on the trip. But old Bernie decides he's going. He wants to go get some portholes, damn it. And we're foreshadowed a little bit because Bernie's kid, I think his like 3-year-old kid Gil, asked him if he was going to be okay. Asked him if he's going to come home from this trip. And the kid was getting a little scared. Bernie's like, of course I'm coming home, son.
When your kid's name is Gil and you're going diving and he's worried about you, you better listen. If I have another kid, I'm going to name him something very water-related like that. That's pretty good, Bernie. I'm going to name him Poseidon. What do we call him for short? That's the question. Don? Nah, that's ridiculous. Pose? Posey? Sidey?
Sidey.
No, just Poseidon. He'll just say, the name's Poseidon. Poseidon Van Schwartz.
So Bernie goes, he gets a couple of dives in on the Northern Pacific. It's off Delaware, off the coast of Delaware, in 150 feet of water.
150.
Easy dive for the likes of the old Chowdhury man. But after, you know, a couple of dives, he and his buddy, Jack, that he's diving with, he starts getting some flu symptoms, which he just brushes off as, you know, just, you know, kind of back in the day. Yeah, you know, you're out there diving, it's cold water, you're getting a little bit of the flu. It was a normal thing. Diver's flu was a normal thing back in the day, before we really had the notion of, you know, some mild Ben's symptoms. So the next day he gets up, he's going to do, you know, knowing that he's coming down with these flu symptoms, he's just going to do a quickie, a little quick little 20-minute dive. Try to get down and, you know, mess around trying to move this hull plate that was down there that he was trying to jack up and move, and so he could get in and
get it
into some more portholes. Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, that, I don't feel, it's not really greed, but it's like that obsession with coming back with something to put behind the old bar.
Well, right. And there's a lot. He goes into detail about, you know, Chris and Chrissy coming back from their Doria trip without any
booty.
And how, although they just did, you know, the Mount Everest of shipwreck dives, but because they didn't have a porthole or a plate or something to come back as an artifact, they felt like they really blew the whole trip.
Yeah.
So Bernie goes down, ties off his oxygen bottle that he's going to use for decompression on the anchor line. He's going to do a quick little dive to 150. His buddy, you know, he told him, don't worry about it. He's just going to go down and do a dive. He felt great after 20 minutes, and he decided that he was going to swim over to the bow section. And he mentions that there was a 10-foot gap between the rest of the wreck and the bow section. He kind of goes into detail about how the whole ship crashed into the bottom and broke apart, and really describes the wreck really extremely well, you know, historically. And then he goes back into how he is going to penetrate into the bow and look for a porthole, or at worst, I'm going to bring back a big old lobster.
At least he's not penetrating the rear.
He comes out. He sees another diver, signals up, hey, I'm going up. Bernie's like, yeah, let's go up. And then he realizes, oh, shit, I got to go get my O2 bottle. I can't just go up now. I got to go get my bottle. I left it back at the anchor line, which is back down there at the stern. So he comes up on the wreck, Brando, to like that 110-foot zone.
Right.
So he gets shallower.
He's smart.
He's making an intelligent decision, right? Rack up a little less deco to do.
Use less gas.
Conserve less. Yeah, conserve
not
some
as
gas.
Narked. He's given up on the booty.
He's given up on the booty. Happens to all of us.
I don't know.
But he's got to make a couple of 100-foot-long swim down to the end of the wreck to get that bottle. So he's swimming fast, swimming hard, building up CO2, and he was in the current now. He wasn't blocked by any of the flow of the water. So he's really working hard. Narcosis starts building up, and is what, you know, we know nowadays, nitrogen narcosis is one thing.
Carbon dioxide.
But that CO2 narcosis is the real bad one, right?
Yeah. Not only is it just, you know, nitrogen narcosis is simply narcosis and goes away when you come up from depth. Carbon dioxide narcosis also is combined with the toxic effects of carbon dioxide and the physiological effects of carbon dioxide. It causes you to breathe more and more and more. What, that urge.
Right. That and the more and more you do it, especially into scuba gear with all the dead air spaces, you just keep enriching that CO2 more and more and more.
And it's thick. So the gas exchange is impeded. It's thick because you're down at 4 or 5 atoms.
So it exacerbates the narcosis.
It's the beginning of the snowball that's a vicious cycle.
Which makes the narcosis just get worse and worse and worse. In addition, he's taking medication for his, you know, flu symptoms. In addition, he's working his ass off. He, you know, is up on the top of the wreck. There's nothing to grab onto and pull and glide. It's strictly swimming. He's a little under the weather, weak and sick. He's losing visibility because people have been down kicking the wreck up a bit. Long story short, he can't find the anchor line.
That's a bad feeling because now you don't have your deco gas.
And you just are swimming and swimming down there. And then he finally decides, he's like, well, I can't swim in this difficult of an area. So he drops back to the 150 zone where there's more wreckage and he can like grab and pull, thinking it'll be easier to move. I'll be a little bit more protected out of the
that,
you know,
current,
flow
that
of the current there
current.
A little bit. So he's up and he's down and he's swimming and swimming and swimming to the point where he finally comes back to a break. He's like, wait, I don't remember there being a break in the wreck at the stern, too. What is going on? And he completely circumnavigated the wreck. He's all the way back at the bow.
Yeah, that's what bad things will do for you, right? when you can only see 5-6 foot portions of the wreck, you could be anywhere on it.
So now he's basically swam 1,500 feet. Around this shipwreck, back and forth and around in 150 feet of water. Narked out of his gourd, right? And he even describes, like, he's narked. He's messed up in his head. He can't think clearly. He's like, where am I at? What is going on? Completely lost. But at the same time, he's like, do I go up here? He's by himself now because he left his buddy to go up when he went looking back for the bottle. Do I go back? He knows I don't have enough gas to do all my decompression, especially now that I swam all the way down and back again looking for that bottle. He looks at his computer. It's got 99 minutes of decompression to do, and he knows it's not 99. Right. He knows it's a lot more than 99, but that's only the maximum number that his computer will show him. He's like, it's got to be close to 2 hours of decompression.
Yeah, it only display 2 digits. So when you've hit 99, it could be anything after that, right?
So he stops swimming, tries to focus on his breathing, tries to really catch his breath, calm his brain down a little bit, get a feel for what he should do, and he bails on the swim to the stern. He's like, I'm not going to make it down there and back again, especially if I get lost again. And he decides he's going to go without a line. He's going to try to make his swim up to the surface right here, just following his bubbles up, knowing I'm going to get bent.
Yeah. Well, that's a big portion of this chapter is Bernie in his mind believing at that point, so I'll get bent, they'll get a chopper, get me to the chamber, I'll go through a table 4, whatever, table 6, and I'll get treated, I'll come out, everything's cool.
Right. I mean, this was the hardiness of the divers back then. Like, the bends was not this mysterious malady that we looked at it, you know, in the 2000s. It was, you know, something that happened every once in a while, kind of.
Well, yeah.
And he's like, okay, I'm going to get bent. Yeah, it'll suck, but I'll be in the hospital before too long, and I'll recover from it. It won't be that big a deal.
And it's a cool helicopter ride.
And bragging rights.
Bragging. Well,
wait till everybody hears, you know, what I just survived.
Well, yeah. The like we've mentioned before on multiple episodes, but especially in the last one, the bend, the hit, the decompression sickness hit, that was like a Purple Heart by many in the community. They viewed it that way.
So he gets all the way to the surface.
Yes.
All the way up from 150, skips his deco.
Of 99 plus minutes.
2 hours of decompression.
Yeah.
Starts waving at the surface and yelling for help. And luckily, the captain just happened to see him. He couldn't hear him over all the noise out on the boat. And he just happens to see this waving arm.
That's super lucky. That is so lucky.
But yeah, because I mean, we're talking in a couple of minutes, he's going to barely be able to move.
That, and he's going to be carried away by the current, and your little tiny head, you know, hundreds of yards out from the charter boat, is very difficult to see. And the longer they sat there and waited for you, not knowing whether you were coming up, whether you were on the wreck still, the further away you'd be floating.
Right, and Nagel is, you know, when he sees him, is like, what is he doing on the surface? like he should not be on the surface. It should be a long time before we see Bernie, right? And they finally get him to the boat, and he says, I fucked up.
I effed up, James. I beeped up.
No, he said, I fucked up.
He did. It seems to be a theme going on in this book.
And the captain's like, well, you didn't do any deco? And he's like, no.
Deco's for losers.
Deco's for losers like Chrissy. You need to do no deco. So he and another... They pull him into the boat, and he's in pain at the surface. Blurred vision, triple vision. He then goes on to describe, you know, the different types of bends.
Yeah, he went right past foreigner stage, right onto triple vision.
Right onto triple vision. He knows it's a neurological hit, he says, and he goes on to describe the differences in DCS hits. He says Dan Crowell got him out of his gear, tossed over his goodie bag, and at this time he starts going deaf in both ears.
What?
He started to go deaf in both ears.
Huh?
His ears, he can't hear anymore. It's a neurological hit.
Definitely, it's neurological. That's a bad one. He's got to be, to a certain degree, in panic mode in his head, in the sense of, oh, I fucked up. This is not going to be just, I'm going to pop in a chopper. Get over
it's not
to the chamber.
Be, I got a little pain in my shoulder. This he's realizing it here. Like, this is bad.
You done fucked up. And he got no booty.
And he was like, and he's like screaming, don't cut my, you know, $1,500 dry suit off of me.
Yeah, I'm going to need this.
I'm going to be back in the water next week.
Exactly. I got a charter scheduled next week. I got a charter tomorrow.
I already paid for another Doria trip next month.
Yeah. I've always thought about that, too. Like, you're going to cut me out of my thousands-of-dollar suit?
Right. I mean, this is 1990s. You know, $1,500 dry suit was a top-end dry. It's not, you know, like, it's the equivalent of getting yourself cut out of a, you know, $4,500 brand-new suit today. And Bernie's not far away. This is where he's kind of realizing. He's like, I don't know if I'm going to survive this chopper ride. This was a bad idea, right? To the point where he's, like, talking about he saw the white light. He saw the tunnel. He's walking down the tunnel to the bright.
It's a trap. Light. It's a tarp, Bernie. It's a tarp. Don't do it.
Yeah, and he's like, the thoughts of his wife and his kid, you know, are like kind of what's keeping him from going to the white light at this point.
Mm-hmm. Wife and kids always keep you from going to the white light. I'm telling you.
So chapter 8, Voice from the Deep, basically takes us over from that point. Bernie is rescued by chopper, picked up and flown to the University of Pennsylvania Hospital, wheeled into the ER. I mean, this is like a 30-page long chapter, really just describing Bernie's chamber ride and his long road to recovery that would begin. He gets to the ER and they're, you know, trying to diagnose him, figure out what's going on. And while he's like, can't hear, but trying to, you know, scream to everybody, I got bent. I need a recompression chamber ASAP, you know, all while he's, you know, trying to make a conscious effort to keep breathing and to stay alive.
Yeah, that's pure willpower. I think you get in a situation like that where you are in so much pain, you just want it to end. It's easy to quit. But family.
Right, yeah, it's basically thoughts of old Gil right after he told him, of course I'm coming back, son.
And you don't want to lie to your kids.
Don't want to lie to your
except
kids.
Except with Santa Claus, Easter Bunny, fucking Tooth Fairy, fucking how they arrived by the stork, et cetera, et cetera. Those are okay. It's a tough one to be going through. Do you think he's regretting ever taking up diving or ever having that booty fever, if you will?
Well, absolutely he does, because he goes on a long description of, you know, the whole process of his chamber ride, you know, describes what a table 6A dive to a equivalent pressure of 165 feet of seawater, the long trip back up to the surface, getting to three ADAs and going on to Puro 2 at 20-minute intervals with a technician there, and describes how overall dangerous the process is. 6 hours he spent sitting there thinking to himself, what did I do? Exactly, what did I do? And then the whole next day, you know, he's still dizzy, still trying to pee. It all takes work. His balance is all messed up. His vision is a wreck. He still is suffering from blurred vision. You know, he describes a lot about his family life and his dad being a doctor and working on, these penicillin drugs, you know, back in the day, and like how his dad would work morning, night, working on these mathematical problems, which he eventually solves this big debate and battle, and just the determination that he learned, you know, growing up for his family, which is basically what he's like describing, like, I can't give up, I can't give up,
right.
I can't let my dad down. He always thought my stupid diving was silly anyways, I should have followed in his footsteps, but no, here I am.
I mean, that's what makes it of value, too, is that risk. And that risk is that you could end up like this if you skirt the rules or you tempt fate.
Now, his doctor eventually, you know, tells him that, dude, you're a mess. You're going to have to completely relearn how to walk. You have to relearn to do everything. Like, your nerves are so messed up. Like, you're going to have to relearn a new neural pathway to get your body to function again. He did another chamber ride, you know, and that still didn't, you know, take care of everything. He could hear a little bit better. He could walk a little bit better, but he was going to have to completely relearn to the point where, you know, the doctor was reluctant to even really fully release him from the hospital. He goes on to describe he was introduced to a Dr. Jennifer Hunt, who he would later visit Bernie and discuss, you know, his dive, discuss his bends hit.
Yeah.
And she would, you know, later release this big study on the psychological, sociological issues and gender issues, and like, why would people do dives like this knowing that they're so dangerous?
Yeah, she was a psychologist, not a medical doctor, but she was studying, she had done research into the law enforcement community and their use of force and et cetera. And she was doing this particular study on divers and the risk they take in its relationship to gender and why they do it.
But it's a long, slow road, and eventually Bernie, you know, gets healthy again. His doc tells him, Your diving days are over, but he's determined. No, I'm diving again. And mm-hmm. Chris and Chrissy Rouse actually, you know, help him get back into the water. And he describes the whole getting back in again down at old Dutch Springs, diving at the quarry, doing a couple of basic little dives. And eventually, even though his doctor said, like, if you ever get bent again,
yeah,
like you're not going to make it. You'll be a crippled pretzel for the rest of your life if you ever do this again.
Isn't he back on the Doria in 1 year?
Back on the Doria, baby. You can't keep me down.
And doesn't he almost screw the pooch again?
Right. And then, like, later on, right, when, you know, at the end of the book, you know, there's a chapter about entitled Ever Deeper, where he talks about his 1997. So this is, you know, well after the passing of the Rouses. He's still actively at it. And he does another trip to the Doria, doing, you know, dives 13, 14 on the Doria. And they had a big problem. They were diving Trimix. His buddy at the time had an O-ring issue, lost a ton of gas. Bernie was diving a full face mask. He had problems with it. A lot of what he discusses in this book, Brando, is the whole lack of communication that everybody has. And one of his thoughts was, we should be in full face masks. We should be on comms. If only Chris and Chrissy could have talked to each other clearly, maybe we wouldn't have the issue. Maybe if I could talk to everybody, like I wouldn't have these problems that I keep having, you know, which later we would realize, well, independent twins was kind of the problem.
Yeah.
Deep air was kind of the problem.
There was a lot of other factors. Yes.
Yeah, it's not that you couldn't talk to your buddy about how fucked up you were, narked out of your gourd. It's the fact that you were fucked up, narked out of your gourd is the problem, not the fact that you couldn't talk to somebody about it.
Yeah, I think, examining it, I can see how that logic would work. If only I was able to tell someone I'm in trouble. But I think a better logic is not to get into the trouble or have practices, techniques, equipment that kind of work towards preventing getting into those circumstances. I think you're right. Comms simply add another complexity that is going to fail on you, especially with electronics. That's what they do. They fail you underwater. That's how they work. I mean, they're nice. They're a nice luxury when they work, but they fail.
Right. I'm with you. You know, I'm a man who has done and taught for years now that don't trust any of it. Expect it all to go. And especially as we start adding more and more electronics to our, you know, system nowadays, like, it's easy to just think it's always going to work perfectly. But in my opinion, as soon as you think that, boy, you're setting yourself up for the...
It's electronics. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of complexity to it. When it works, it's great. And I'm not saying electronics are bad and, like, let's not use them ever. I harken back even to my days in the Air Force and when the F-16s were coming out and they're fly-by-wire, which means they're electronic, and all of the issues they were having there, too. It's when you introduce electronics into a harsh environment, you open up the door for a lot of potential failure. That's all. So
all these issues that he and his buddy were having at the time made him start to have these flashbacks of his big Benz hit on the Northern Pacific. So he decides to skip out on the next dive. And his buddy, whole Wolfgang,
Wolfie,
ends up going solo, but again, had more problems. His reg stopped working. His gauges went bad. Trapped hoses. But, you know, even to the point where he's like, man, I should have stayed. But he made it back. So he does his 14th dive on the Doria. And they had more equipment problems. They go back again because he's got artifact fever, Brando.
It's booty fever.
He's diving a gas switching block.
I've tried those.
Because, you know, the switching, the manual switching of independent twins is a bit of a process.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you've got to switch regulators,
the switching,
right?
Switching regulators and switching bottles is a process that became difficult. So in this time, in this late 90s, they were designing, you know, pieces of equipment to make the process easier. Just this little block I can go.
Aren't we kind of going through a little same thing with old side mount diving, which essentially is independent twins?
Essentially, it is. You know, it is. And it's not essentially. It is independent twins.
It's essentially. They're independent twins in the sense of the two separate bottles, though, versus the independent twins on your back.
Bernie was using this switching block, which, as he's changing equipment configurations and at the last minute he's, you know, adding this new stuff, throws on a stage bottle, which is now in the way of the block as he's realizing underwater, like,
son of a bitch.
I can't get to this.
Has that ever happened?
And he's down there on the Toria, yeah. 200 plus feet, and he realizes, oh, shit. I've only got, like, half my gas.
Well, I would say move your stage bottle and switch your gas.
Well, there he is, but now he's 200 plus feet of water. His hands are numb.
They're little blocks of ice.
Frozen blocks of ice for hands and fingers. He doesn't have the manual dexterity. So he tries, you know, he's like, all right, I'm thumbing the dive. He's only got half of his gas supply. He decides, well, I'm going to just switch to this stage bottle of air. Gets on it. Wow, this thing is like really low. Oh, shit.
What the hell happened?
Well, it turns out, like, he would later find out from other divers, like, oh, yeah, that thing was leaking the whole time.
Oh, thanks, man.
But he realizes, oh, shit, like, I don't have enough gas in this. So he's got to go back to his back gas. Then at least he's got some Tri-Mix left in his back gas. He's going to have to go to that. But he breathes that thing down to, like, it's almost empty. He's like, okay, I've got a spare regulator back here that's attached to these bottles. I'm going to have to switch. But he's in a full face mask, which, as you know, adds a whole... This is something that people go, oh, I want to dive a full face mask, man. But they don't think about the other part of the full face mask when the luxury of the full face mask has to be taken away because of an equipment issue. Because now it's not just changing a regulator.
Yeah, take off your reg and mask. So you lose both vision and gas, and here we go. And you're by yourself.
And this is a time where buoyancy control on an ascent was not really buoyancy control. It was...
Hold on to a line.
And that line is what's keeping me from going up or down for the most part. Maybe you're strapping in the John line, you know, but even still, like, you're in midwater trying to do something that you've only ever practiced in the past...
Probably,
you know, kneeling exactly. On the bottom, and now I got to do this in midwater. So he's got to take off his full face mask, switch to his backup regulator. He's got to get into his goodie bag, which is the bottom of his goodie bag, is where he just throws that spare mask, maybe, because I'm never going to need that damn thing. But oh shit, now I need that damn thing. So he's got to dig through to try to get to his spare mask. However, Bernie's also got this other problem of he's got bad ears.
What?
So he's got bad ears. His ears are bad.
The hearing impaired. Hopefully they're not listening. Obviously they're not listening because they're hearing impaired. But
they might be reading the transcript now, though.
Like, we hate you.
So he's got this special hood that's got like a special earplug built into it, so that his ears don't get hit with that cold, wet water, which sends him into vertigo. But now he's got to remove his full face mask.
Mm-hmm. Which is going to put cold water into that hood, into his ears.
Bam! Yeah, starts spinning. No mask. Switches to the regulator. Guess what? Guess what regulator of his two independent bottles that his spare regulator is connected to? Is it connected to the one that's full of gas?
No.
Or the one that's also empty of gas?
Yeah.
Boom, you got it. Shit, this is the wrong, it's on the wrong bottle. He's still in 70 feet of water, no mask, nobody,
no gas
to breathe. Yeah. He's like, oh, fuck, here we go again. Do I surface right now and skip all my decompression and I'm going to be crippled for the rest of my life? The doc already told me. Could you imagine going back into the doc? Who told you?
Why didn't you tell me, man?
I told you, don't ever do this again. Why are you here again?
Wow.
Or do I stay here, right, and just drown right here underwater. Like, what am I going to do? Like, what is the lesser of my two evils? Where's my buddy Wolfgang at?
Oh, Wolfie.
He can't see. He's got no mask. And he's like, the boat has got O2 hanging at 20 feet nowadays.
Yeah.
Do I just go to the 20-foot, try to get on that regulator, which is basically surface-supplied O2? He's not going to have to worry about it running out. But I'm still going to skip a shitload of decompression from 70 feet up to 20 feet as the regulator is getting harder and harder and harder to breathe. So, yeah, he decides, yeah, I'm going to go up. And boom, he runs into Wolfgang. But he's got no mass. He's just like flailingly trying to give the, you know, then he goes into the whole big thing about what the divers signal for out of air, the slashing at the throat, and he describes all of that.
Well, I would hope old Wolfie would look over and see a guy with no nothing in his mouth and a no mask, and it would just be instinctual. Here's a fucking regulator.
yeah, and he and Wolfie kind of, you know, fumble around for a bit. And he talks about it. He's got a bright pink regulator, which he can tell is pink. And most macho divers would never be seen with a pink regulator. But the smartness of the bright color, you know, as an emergency, and he finally gets him a regulator, but he's dumps him off this regulator of bat gas, not a deco mix. But he's like, I needed something to breathe. You know, anything is better than nothing. So he's got vertigo. He's spinning around. Wolfie gives him a spare bottle of O2 that he starts breathing in 40 feet of water. So now he's like, he's fearing, like, I'm in 40 feet of water on O2. I remember what happened to our buddy, old Ed Solner there. So he bails on that bottle and goes up to 20 feet to get on that boat O2 and just decides, I'm going to stay here as long as I can.
That would have probably been my first choice. But, of course, hindsight's 20/20. I'm not back in the early 90s trying to muddle my way through technical diving.
And this is what they're doing, muddling their way through technical diving. And he describes the method of decompression that he's about to do, Brando. Is something that they referred to on the boat as the modified Yugoslavian method of deco.
Those yugs, man.
Where you just basically, you know, tried to assemble a little bit of order out of the chaos that was happening. You know, Wolfgang surfaced, tells everybody on the boat, you know, about Bernie. They lowered down a set of doubles for him, you know, to hang off so he could do air breaks, because breathing pure O2 at a 1.6 constantly is not good for your lungs at all. And this modified Yugoslavian method of deco is basically you stay until you're feeling okay, and then you slowly start to come up a bit till it hurts. When it starts hurting, you go back down until the pain goes away, and you stay a little bit longer, and then you try coming up again until it hurts, and then you stop and you go back down again until the pain goes away, and which is basically what he's doing here. And he ended up doing several hours of decompression.
Yeah.
And was grateful that he made it to the surface with no real symptoms.
Yeah, he should be grateful.
And he's, you know, once again thinking of his wife and kid, and is just like, Jesus, Bernie, what are you doing?
I need to change something. I need to make some changes. Yeah.
I need to reevaluate my my life's decisions. And he says, you know, later that night, his wife told him that his buddy, guy by the name of Tony Smith, died doing just a little warm water wreck off of the coast of North Carolina. Another hardcore deep diving cold water northeast wrecker dies on a little dive in North Carolina in like 130 feet of water, like recreational limits. But he jumped in, Brando, with his rig, like if he was wearing his big, thick, heavy, you know, suit from the northeast, but he's just in a warm water suit, so he's way overweighted.
Yeah,
he didn't do any real pre-dive checks, didn't go through any routines, jumps in with a shitload of gas, nothing turned on,
and didn't have the wherewithal to be able to reach back and turn it on. That's happened more than once, though, James. I mean, that's one of the reasons it's come about in classes that you need to be able to reach your valves.
And we hit another philosophical discussion, you know, that, you know, Bernie like brings up throughout this book of like he's finally realizing, like, you know, this isn't just me.
Yeah.
That's got to deal with this dive that I'm doing. I mean, there's other people in the water. There's the boat crew has to deal with these people, my wife and my kid, my family. Do I really have the right to put myself at risk like this to do this thing that I love so much?
I would say it's a great philosophical topic for discussion. You know, at what point do you have an obligation to everyone that cares for you or everyone that's possibly affected by you and your actions? The problem with that discussion is no one lives in a vacuum, and every minute thing you do has some kind of effect on not only the people you love, but the world in and of itself. So it's one you'll get lost in, you'll never be able to answer. That's an age-old discussion, isn't it?
I think this is a philosophical discussion that certainly needs to be had, because there is a bit of that butterfly effect of everything that we do, especially when, you know, we want to do stuff that's out of the physical and physiological world of where us as humans were intended to go. And it's amazing that we push that limit. But there is that balance of both sides of who's affected by my poor choices, my bad decisions, weird, silly things that just come out of nowhere that I wasn't anticipating.
Well, the thing is, you know, a couple of words there, poor choices and bad decisions that's a hindsight a lot of times. Not all the time. Sometimes you purposely make a stupid decision because you think, I'll get away with it or whatnot. But you can take this to the nth degree because it's a risk thing. So what degree of risk is acceptable? Every day we take a risk. You take a risk crossing a street, for that matter. You know, you're always taking risks. Something like technical diving obviously is pushing those risks. You're taking an inordinate amount of risk for the benefit of sometimes for your enjoyment. Is that risk versus the reward that you get? Is that possible detriment to your family and loved ones and the people that might have to risk themselves to go get your body? Is that worth it? But, I mean, we can get tied up in this question into this giant knot where we can't move.
Oh, right, exactly. Because, I mean, Bernie went out of his way, and so did the Rouses, to get what they thought was the additional education, to get the additional equipment so that they were making themselves as little of a risk as possible. And he's doing all the right things all
in
along
his
the
mind,
way. So
yeah,
this isn't risky, son. This isn't risky, wife. I'm a great diver. Like, I've gone out of my way to make sure that I'm safe. And then he's realizing, shit happens.
There's still risk. And a lot of everything that you spoke about on this particular dive, almost everything can be piled on Bernie's shoulders there. There are a lot of multiple failure points in his philosophy and in his practice. And those failure points all came to fruition as far as
right
you know. And I'm not trying to criticize Bernie. These guys were blazing a trail, right?
Yeah, if only he would have had a pink regulator.
Exactly.
Regulator instead of the pink regulator. Yeah. I'd have seen it fast.
Or
you know, color combo.
He had the full face mask on, but it's no good. The comms don't work if they're not hooked to somebody else.
I knew,
you know?
I shouldn't have done the emergency switch block. It was the switch block. It was thinking back on it, now hindsight being 2020 as it is, that switch block, you know. Like, yeah, like what is it? Like and at the end of the day, to sit there and like to try to nitpick each and every one of those isn't really the answer.
Right. You got to go further. You've got to go further back. And it almost always comes to mindset. Discipline, mindset, and practice with things like this. It's easy to sit back and look at it with the clarity of hindsight and go, you should have done this and you should have done that and the other thing. But almost always, those are misleading and they're not at the root of it. I mean, this actually goes to human factors. And what's at the root of these problems?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a common characteristic at the root.
And I think the root of it for Bernie, especially here in 1997, was he scared himself once again, you know, and he's like, I've got a career, I've got a family,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he got scared about those risks.
Sometimes.
And, yeah, something's got to give.
Sometimes you need to be scared. Maybe we should get a scared straight program for divers. Hey, you little bitch, I'm going to take you underwater and make you my bitch.
That sounds like my class that I'm going to do next week. Ah, so there you go, people. There's a whole nother section of The Last Dive. You know, we look at Bernie's, you know, very couple of scary dives, also his artifact fever and the glory of coming back with booty and how it affects the mindset of the diver and putting ourselves and what we're going to see. You know, the same kind of thing is what's going to happen when we revisit Chris and Chrissy and just being so focused on coming away with the captain's logbook that it puts them in a situation where, unfortunately, they're going to have a really, really terrifying end of their lives. So join us again, people, next week for the exciting conclusion of The Last Dive. All right, everybody, we'll talk to you next week.
Until then, don't you go changing. Hey, James, we could call this the Megan Trainor episode because she knows that she's all about that bass and she's bringing booty back.
The Great Dive Podcast is hosted by your buddies, James and Brando. What?